يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Hello and welcome to Middle East Analysis. We're joined by Dr. Harry Hagopian, our usual studio guest. As you probably know by now, Harry is an international lawyer, political commentator and former Assistant General Secretary of the Middle East Council of Churches, amongst other things. How are you doing, Harry?
Good morning, James.
Now, plenty to talk about, as there always is. And let's start with Libya. I could start by saying that there's been sort of little headline news, really, apart from the ongoing search for Colonel Gaddafi, but perhaps it's better for us to talk about Libya in transition, what that actually means and what the state of play is just now.
I think it is pretty much Libya in transition at the moment. Yes, they're still trying to locate Colonel Gaddafi, but I don't think that is really the utmost priority in the minds of the National Transitional Council. We know that he is somewhere between Sirte and Sabha, probably not too far from Bani Walid, and this is basically the area that the revolutionary forces have not yet taken over because they're negotiating with the tribal elders to enter those towns without any more bloodletting. So in that sense, his location is pretty much known, and the question is, will he stay there and be caught, or will he flee into one of the African countries across the border? Now, there have been reports of his son Saif al-Islam, who was the heir apparent at one stage in the neighborhood of Bani Walid. So that is an interesting point. We shouldn't ignore the fact that he's still around, that he's coming up with statements. He came up with another declaration over a telephone line last night asking the Libyans to fight the Western forces who are helping the revolutionaries recolonize Libya. So he's into mischief making, but I really think that we are now moving into a post-Gaddafi situation. And the idea is, what do we do with the situation? Now, the three people who are really running the National Transitional Council at the moment are Mahmoud Jibril, Mustafa Abdul Jalil and Ali Tarhouni. Now, the first, Mahmoud Jibril and Ali Tarhouni, are very Western educated. They're graduates of American universities. Mustafa Abdul Jalil used to be the Minister of Justice under Gaddafi, but left immediately when the 17th of February uprising started, and he's now become almost the spokesperson for this transitional body. All three of them, between chair, the equivalent of prime minister, and a finance minister, are working together in order to try and bring some security and some calm across the whole of the country. The point is that when we talk about the National Transition Council, it sounds much more impressive than it really is. It's just a body that hopefully will lead to constitutional changes and to elections that will take Libya into another democratic state, into another reality in a year's time, in a couple of years' time. And the people who are actually fighting, or the people who are keeping the place safe, are the rebels or revolutionaries, which are basically atomized in small groups. For instance, you have them in Tripoli, you have them in Benghazi, you have them around Sirte, you have them in different parts of the country. And once those come together, and once the whole country is free of the Gaddafi loyalists, then I think we might begin to see the emergence of a new Libya.
Can I make one quick point?
Do that.
One thing that I'm thinking, is it possible, and you've alluded to this, that it quite suits the National Transitional Council not to find Gaddafi, a neutered Gaddafi, we'd have to say at this stage, so he's not much of a threat, because then they don't have to deal with that issue of tribal harmony, which is going to come up at some point, and some of those more sort of, you know, there's a reasonable amount of unity against the figure of Gaddafi. So a neutered Gaddafi somewhere in the south, you know, it's not such a bad thing, is it?
It's not such a bad thing, and this is why I don't think it is on the topmost list of the priorities of the NTC. Now, If you look at Sirte, which is Gaddafi's homeland, it's got the Kadhafa tribe, which is Colonel Gaddafi's tribe. If you look at Bani Walid and further south into Sabha, it's the Warfala tribe, which has been loyal to Gaddafi because they tried to rise up against him in the 90s. He came down very hard on them, changed their leaders, and now they're also viewed as being somewhat still pro-Gaddafi. So the priority for the NTC is to try and win those tribal elders toward the NTC and the revolution and the changing face of Libya, rather than worry too much about Gaddafi. But in so doing, what is very important, James, and this is something where we did one of the most egregious mistakes in Iraq, for instance, is that we supported the dismantling of all the institutions of the country. And therefore, we had an absolute black hole, a void, and the whole thing collapsed or crumbled. We should make sure that we don't do that and that we actually use the existing institutions, structures of the country in a different way to support the aims of the revolution rather than otherwise. It's very interesting. A member of the NTC, somebody by the name of Adel Senussi, said something to the effect that if we say, that was what he said, get rid of whoever was part of the system, we would have to get rid of the whole population, because everybody in some way or another was tied into the Gaddafi system, because for 42 years this man has been running the country with a very iron hand, granted, and therefore the idea is not to dismantle everything, a sort of Iraqi style debatification, but in order to try and keep the country running so that the oil gets online again, the offices open, the country becomes more secure and peaceful, and then yes, we will have to deal with Gaddafi, because we don't want Gaddafi to become another bin Laden coming up with all sorts of statements which would stir up more unrest and trouble in the country with those pockets of loyalists who would still be in the country no matter what.
Let's move on to Syria at this point. I find myself still alarmed by the things I have seen. Bear in mind, not from a free press, things that have been smuggled out and a reality that we've actually managed to cast our eyes upon. I'm probably more alarmed by the thought of what we might not be seeing. And I know that you've recently watched a Newsnight interview that stirred a few thoughts in you, Harry.
It did stir a few horrible thoughts in me. I mean, I worry about Syria. I worry about Syria for many, many reasons, because there is really a lot of chaos and there is a lot of oppression and much bloodletting and many, many deaths, too many deaths that are basically outnumbering anything else that has happened within the this chapter that we still call the Arab Spring, but which I now call the Arab Awakening, because it's past its spring season. I was watching Newsnight with Jeremy Paxman this week, and he had on his program a young man from Homs. And this man has dual nationality. He's Syrian by birth and by upbringing, but he and his family live in the UK, and he found himself in Syria. He was there for a few months, and he was telling Jeremy Paxman the atrocities that are happening in Homs, the killings, the oppression, the beatings, the detentions. And if you look at what is happening there, you really, really feel sorry for the Syrian people, who 6 months almost into the beginning of their uprising, they're still going there, they're still fighting in the streets, they're still demonstrating in the streets, largely peacefully, despite the tanks, the bullets, and the oppression of a vast military infrastructure that is pitted against them. And they're doing all this without really much help from anybody, whether from the Arab League, whether from any other country, let alone from us in the West, except at least we in the West have tried some to apply some moral pressure, but nothing in the sense that would make President Bashar al-Assad sit up and apply those reforms that he's been promising for so long, but that have not filtered to the streets.
So why are the protesters going out night after night, technically to die?
technically to die. And I was thinking about them. If I were there, would I ever have the courage to do it? If you were there, would you have the courage to do this every night, to go out of the mosques at night after evening prayers and demonstrate in the way they do? And some of the slogans they're chanting now, it's no longer we call for the overthrow of the president. Now it's a question of we call for the hanging of the president or for the killing of the president. It's gone beyond that. Now you would wonder why, when they haven't had the kind of support that we talk about, when they have been demonstrating day in, day out, night in, night out, but have not actually made any real dent beyond what they had made 2-3 months ago. If we look at the two main key cities for me, Aleppo and Damascus, they're pretty much still calm compared to the rest of Syria. Damascus is the capital, Aleppo is the commercial capital. The question that I would ask is the following: what is going through President Assad's mind and what's going through the demonstrators' minds? As far as the president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, is concerned, I think he's in a paradox. He's caught between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, I think that if he today stops all the operations like the Arab League would have wanted him to do and many other people, including the Turks and the Russians, want him to do, then the subsequent rising tide of demonstrations will still try to drive him out. So stopping the oppression and the military subjugation of the people would not work. But on the other hand, if he continues applying force against his citizens who are revolting against him, eventually the citizens are still fighting back and they will still try to drive him out. So he's caught between a rock and a hard place, and he's in a difficult situation as any tin pot dictator or oppressor would be. Now, what about the people? You would say, okay, so many of them are dead. We're talking about over 2,300, 2,400 deaths. We're talking about tens of thousands detained, injured, disappeared. I believe, James, that the reason why those people are going out night in, night out, and this young man on Jeremy Paxman's program this week mentioned it, is that they have gone beyond the point of no return. He said to Jeremy, he said, listen, the security forces, the intelligence services in Syria have photos and files on every single one, pretty much, who have been demonstrating over the past 5-6 months. If we stop, they will come and get every one of us, arrest us, torture us, detain us, even kill us. We cannot afford to stop, because stopping would be signing our death warrant. And I believe that is really what is happening, that they are afraid to stop, because if they stop, they know that they're going towards certain arrest, torture, and even death. So they're continuing their fight in the hope that they would up the ante enough for a dramatic change to completely reconfigure the realities of that country and give them what they're wanting, which is dignity and rights as citizens of a very important part of the Arab world.
I mean, a cornered animal can be a very dangerous thing.
Absolutely.
The picture you've painted there is of someone that almost can only come out fighting and basically fighting dirtier and dirtier as this goes on.
So I think that's what he's doing. He and his inner circle, his family and his clan, are fighting dirty, and all they can do is fight. All the demonstrators can do are demonstrate back, because they don't have any other option. So we're caught in a very difficult situation, and unless somebody finds a way of pressuring the regime to buckle down by leaving gracefully, even at this most ungracious of moments, then we're in for some more bloodbaths. And I really, really feel sorry for the people of Syria. I pray for them, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners do too.
We do have the school of thought, mooted by some, that is to give President Bashar al-Assad time to implement the reforms that he's been proposing and re-proposing a few times in his public speaking. Even from the Lebanese Maronite Patriarch, who has been in France, obviously, mm-hmm. as an ally of Lebanon, as it were. Is it an option at all, or is it just past that, really?
As far as Syria is concerned, the three fears that Patriarch El-Rai has are that, one, there would be civil war in Syria. Two, that the violence cannot be resolved by violence, but that at some stage there has to be dialogue. And thirdly, that the fundamentalist or the radical Islamists would come into power and therefore they would make the life of the Christian communities. And remember, we've often talked about the Christians of Syria, that the new realities politically would make the lives of Christians more untenable and more difficult. And therefore, one of the things he said in an interview he gave recently is give President Bashar al-Assad time to apply some of the reforms. Otherwise, we will end up in an Iraqi situation where the Christians will be targeted and half of the Christian population in Iraq, as you well know, is no longer there. And he is worried about the fragmentation of the Arab world into sectarian states. Now, all this is a very Christian-centric thinking, which makes sense when you're living there and you're looking at the picture of how do I make sure that my community, the indigenous, local, largely Arab Christians of the whole MENA region, including Syria, how do I try to ensure a certain modicum of safety, well-being, and survival for them? It makes sense psychologically for me in that sense. It doesn't make sense for me politically because the Christian communities are part and parcel of the Arab world. They're part and parcel of the Arab population. They've got Arab culture and Arab genes and Arab DNA as much as anybody else. The difference between them and the Sunnis, the Shias, the Druze, the Alawites, the Kurds, is that they actually believe in our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, and they have a different faith reference.
Well, let's finish, Harry. I mean, it's September, isn't it? And if there's one date in September that for the last 10 years has stuck in people's minds, it's the 11th, of course.
Oh, yes.
And it's 10 years. It's a decade since those terror attacks on New York and the Pentagon. Awareness Sunday, obviously, is coming up on the 11th. And there's going to be a service at Westminster Abbey to mark that anniversary. Tell us a little bit about your thinking, because you and I have talked in the past, and there's never been really thorough public analysis of 9/11, has there?
No, there hasn't. And hopefully, James, you will kindly link this podcast to the new article that I just came out with 2 days ago, which analyzes the 10th anniversary of the what we call the 9/11 atrocities or attacks in the USA. I mean, there I unravel my thoughts quite a bit. What I would say is the following. There are two ways I look at it. I look at it politically and I look at it from a Christian and religious perspective. Politically, I think there are two fundamental points. The first one is that despite the fact that 10 years have passed since that tragedy struck the USA, we haven't really thought carefully through what did it mean? Why did these people do what they did? What is the significance of the attacks on America and their constant attacks or attempts to attack Western interests? And I think what we have done with this global war on terror and with our piecemeal attacks here and there is, yes, we have thankfully thwarted many other terrorist attacks, but we have thought tactically, we haven't thought strategically, we haven't gone beyond the obvious into analyzing the situation and dealing with it, perhaps because we don't have the resources and we don't have the patience and we don't have the time for it. But that's what we need to do. And the other thing that comes hand in hand with that politically is, on the one hand, we have failed, in my opinion, as the West, to think about those attacks and similar ones like 7/7, which we witnessed in 2005 here in London, and say why and how do we deal with it. And then the flip side of this argument is, what about all the Islamist forces within the MENA, revolutionary forces and popular revolts? How would they then act once they come to power? And what would be the relationship we have as the West with those forces that are on the ascendant at the moment, and they are going to be part and parcel of the political reality of the whole MENA region? Religiously, with Awareness Sunday, which we are commemorating at Westminster Abbey on Sunday, is basically an attempt to try and think about the Christian values of reconciliation, forgiveness, compassion, thinking of the other, the poor, the disenfranchised, people who think differently from us. For me, James, one of the magical moments of Jesus' ministry on earth was his Sermon on the Mount. Mm. And I always follow that as an example. I always fail, but I always follow that as an example. And for that service, it's a question of how do those elements come together to help us in our lives and in the future as human beings on this earth? And how do we basically use religion to bring people together for the good rather than use religion to divide people and create more violence in the name of a God who would certainly not, in my view, condone any of the violence we commit in his name?
Harry, we'll turn our attention a little bit more to the case for Palestinian statehood on our next podcast. So do join us again in a few weeks and we can really unravel exactly the pros and cons of that.
That's a key issue that's happening in New York, that's playing out in New York over what will happen with the Palestinian bid for statehood, James. And we in the Catholic Bishops' Conference here of England and Wales here, we have a lot to do with the situation in the Holy Land in its larger geographical understanding. So I look forward to perhaps having a podcast where we will forget the rest of the MENA world, if possible, and just focus for 10-15 minutes on what is happening to Palestine and Palestinian Muslims and Christians.
That'll be next time up on Middle East Analysis. Dr. Harry Hagopian, thanks ever so much.
Thank you.